Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, how Michelangelo envisaged the figure of Saint John the Baptist on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. A spiritual reflection focusing on love by well-known author and theologian Father Gerald O'Collins. But first, our reflection on this week's Sunday Gospel, a programme written and presented by Gilbe Vilacqua by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins as always with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us. Stay tuned.
Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to give me my share of our inheritance." He replied, "Friend, who has set me up as your judge or arbiter?" Then he said to the crowd, "Avoid greed in all its forms. A man may be wealthy, but his possessions do not guarantee him life." He told them a parable in these words. "There was a rich man who had a good harvest. 'What shall I do?' he asked himself. 'I have no place to store my harvest.' 'I know,' he said. 'I will pull down my grain bins and build larger ones. All my grain and my goods will go there. Then I will say to myself, you have blessings in reserve for years to come. Relax, eat heartily, drink well, enjoy yourself.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life shall be required of you. To whom will all this piled up wealth of yours go?' That is the way it works with the man who grows rich for himself instead of growing rich in the sight of God."
From the quiet intimacy of last week's Gospel, when Jesus is alone with his apostles teaching them how to pray, we now find him in the midst of an immense crowd, as St. Luke writes.
"Meanwhile, the people had gathered in their thousands, so that they were treading on one another, and he began to speak, first of all, to his disciples."
And it's almost as if this attention to his immediate followers makes the crowd impatient, so that one man plucks up courage and provokes Jesus with a totally irrelevant personal question. "Tell my brother to give me my share of our inheritance." Irrelevant for us, perhaps, but not for the people in that crowd, as Piero Bargellini explains.
"The Jews often turn to the rabbis, teachers of religious doctrine, to make judgments also on practical matters, legal, even administrative problems. The man in the crowd believed that Jesus, too, could help him settle his very personal problem of a controversial inheritance which a brother, it seems, would not share with him."
There were very clear rules laid down regarding inheritance. Women were disregarded, as we're told in a guidebook on life in Bible times.
"The right of inheritance followed the male. If an Israelite had only daughters and wanted to preserve his family inheritance, his daughters had to marry within their tribe because the inheritance could not be transferred to another tribe."
And the firstborn son was particularly favoured, for when the father died, he received a double portion of the family inheritance. Interesting when we remember the parable of the prodigal son. The fury of the elder son, when the father kills the fatted calf on his brother's return, seems even more out of place. His double share of the inheritance was sure, and his father confirms this when he says, "All I have is yours." Certainly, brothers in the Bible, whether in parable or in reality, seem frequently to have been at odds. And there's surely nothing more likely to produce dissension than a question of inheritance, even more so when the inheritance is large, as Francis Bacon warned in 1612. "A great estate left to an heir is as a lure to all the birds of prey round about to seize on him, if he be not the better established in years and judgment." Jesus, while refusing to enter into discussion of a man's family affairs, uses the occasion to preach once more on the true values, on the need to pursue spiritual rather than material wealth, as a scholar notes.
It is not Jesus' task to decide on the division of material goods among men. He always aims at the inner conversion of a man, from a convinced heart, detached from unreal and deceptive material riches, will spring the solid virtues of justice and charity.
Avoid greed in all its forms. Greed, or covetousness, one of the seven deadly or capital sins, and explained as an excessive love of riches and earthly goods. According to Henri Nouwen, Belgian writer on spirituality, anger and greed are the two main enemies of the spiritual life.
When my sense of self depends on what I can acquire, greed flares up when my desires are frustrated.
In the 4th century, St. Augustine warned in his work De Agone Christiano, or Christian Combat.
The devil rules over lovers of temporal goods belonging to this visible world, not because he is lord of this world, but because he is ruler of those covetous desires by which we long for all that passes away.
People in the Middle Ages were very conscious of the power of the devil, and both artists and poets depicted hell and the torments of its inmates in graphic detail. None more vividly than Dante. In Canto 7 of his Inferno, he imagines hoarders and misers condemned to roll immense boulders from one side of the fourth circle of hell towards the other side, until they collide with those of the spendthrifts rolling theirs in the opposite direction.
Some left, some right, who yelled out as they rolled these great weights with their chests to make advance. They crashed together, turned and slowly bowled their weights back round. And then they boom. Why niggard gold? To hear, why squander gold? So they return along their circuit's gloom, in their first tracks towards the other side. And turning there, the same reproach resume. And having done so, then again divide, return along the same half-circle's curve, until the next joust comes, and they collide.
And to the horrified Dante, his companion, the Latin poet Virgil, comments.
Now, my son, see to what a mock are brought the goods of fortune's keeping, and how soon, though to possess them still is all man's thought, for all the gold there is beneath the moon, or ever was, could never offer rest to one of these drawn souls who sought that boon.
Our Lord paints no such picture of punishment, but puts his teaching in a parable his listeners could understand. To have a good harvest would make any farmer or landowner happy, but this man's harvest is such that he needs to build bigger barns in order to house it all. What's more, he feels so secure that he decides to take it easy and enjoy life. But there's something he's forgotten. We all know the old adage, "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die." It's a variation of a phrase of Isaiah, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die." It was a traditional saying of the Egyptians, we're told, who at their banquets exhibited a skeleton to the guests to remind them of the brevity of life. Our rich man of the parable has forgotten his Isaiah and is perhaps remembering a slightly different scriptural motto from Ecclesiastes.
A man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink, and to be merry.
Carpe diem, seize the day, was the constant theme of the old Persian poet Omar Khayyam.
Ah, make the most of what we yet may spend, before we too into the dust descend. Ah, fill the cup, what boots it to repeat how time is slipping underneath our feet.
But Khayyam is well aware of the tenuous quality of material goods.
The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone. And those who husbanded the golden grain, and those who flung it to the winds like rain, alike to no such aureate earth are turned as, buried once, men want dug up again.
Jesus ends his parable with the sobering words of God, who tells the man that his life, which he was going to enjoy, will be required of him that very night. And to whom will all this piled-up wealth of yours go? How hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of God, Jesus would say, surely with a sigh, when the rich young man turned away, unable to renounce his great wealth. And as William Caxton, who printed the first book in English, put it, riches increase avarice in a covetous man. Another popular phrase, money is the root of all evil, is taken from St. Paul's first letter to Timothy, when he wrote, the love of money is the root of all evils. And Chaucer, in his Canterbury Tales, has the pardoner say,
I preach for nothing but for greed of gain, and use the same old text, as bold as brass, radix malorum est cupiditas.
Cupiditas, cupidity, covetousness, greed, avarice. Call it what you will. Whether or not it is the root of all evils, it is certainly an insidious plant. St. Ambrose, in one of his letters, wrote,
happy is the man who has been able to cut out the root of vices, avarice. What do superfluous riches profit in this world when they do not assist our birth or impede our dying? We are born into this world naked. We leave it without a cent. We are buried without our inheritance.
The parable Jesus recounted in today's gospel was not the last he was to tell on the subject. Later came that of Dives and Lazarus. And before he came to Jerusalem, he passed through Jericho, where the tax collector Zacchaeus made a dramatic U-turn. For, as a biblical scholar comments,
with Jesus has arrived the moment of salvation. The love of God goes out to sinners, and conversion leads to indifference to wealth and to charity through joy.
When Jesus entered the house of Zacchaeus, the Pharisees murmured their disapproval. What was their reaction, one may wonder, when this public sinner made the great renunciation, the radical change of life? Some, perhaps, were convinced. Others may well have been sceptical or even laughed. As Dickens in A Christmas Carol wrote, when the miser Scrooge was converted from his grasping ways. It's the same story, really.
He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh, and little heeded them. For he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good, at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset. And knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him.
And many thanks once again to Jill Bevilacqua for this beautiful programme. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, time to go arty with our Professor of Fine Arts, Breeda Ennis, who helps us better understand the figure of St. John the Baptist on the walls of the Sistine Chapel, in particular in the Last Judgment fresco. Breeda, we're still speaking about the last judgment. We didn't think we'd ever end somehow.
And we're if we did all 400 figures, we would be here for the next 2 years.
We're going to speak about a very important figure again today. Looking at the fresco, he's to the left of Christ.
Yes, yes.
And he's John the Baptist.
Yes. Looking as intense as he is described, in a sense, because a very intense figure and
a devilish face, in a way.
Well, no, it's almost like it's severe more than devilish. No, he's very severe, but he's generally portrayed dressed in unkempt clothes and looking like a wild man from the desert. And looking very severe, which in fact he was. Yeah, because actually what he's trying to do is, no, more than that, he's trying to warn people, like, Messiah is coming. He's very near. So wake up, you people. This is the feeling you get from this figure. And it's lovely when you look at the eyes. I mean, he has a hooked nose. He's not exactly a fabulous-looking individual. He's not a beautiful-looking man, if you want to put it that way. But there was a wonderful expression in his eyes, though. Look, he's looking with an adoration at the figure of Christ the Judge in the middle. Because this was the content of his message. This was his role. And he's a very special man. He's celebrated on the 24th of June, which is his birthday. On the 29th of August as well, which was the day of his martyrdom. So he's the only saint, along with the Virgin Mary and Jesus, whose birthday is celebrated as a feast, an official church feast. All the others are celebrated on the day of their martyrdom or their death. And this is because he was sanctified already before his birth, because his actual birth was miraculous in a sense, and he prepared humanity for the coming of Christ.
So he's an in-between man. He's between the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yes, he's the last prophet from the Old Testament and the first one of the New. So he is a link.
The glue.
Well, yeah, more than that, it's almost like he clasps the two. He brings the two books together.
Binds them.
More than even binding them, it's almost like he's putting some wonderful gold clip on the two of them to hold them together strongly. This is the feeling I always get.
That's a beautiful image.
He's a very, very important key figure in the linking of the two books. I mean, when I think of him in terms of the key figure, I'm jumping over also to St. Peter with his keys at the same thing. Because you always find some types of images that tend to float around certain figures. And he's one of these people.
Well, the way they're placed.
They're the two, let's say, the standing straight up and the two strongest, more muscular figures in the Last Judgment fresco. Because the Christ figure, yes, it is a muscular one, but it's more refined. The figures of John the Baptist and Peter are stronger and more rugged, let's say. A little bit like Hercules, the statue of Hercules. So when people asked him who he was, St. John, he answered, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness." And you can actually feel the intensity of this in this face that you see here. And look, his arms are down by his sides. So it's almost like he understands that what he had to do was done. And of course, remember that Christ chose him to be baptized. So he was baptizing before the arrival of Christ. And then the real baptism, he had this wonderful gift that Christ chose him to be baptized in the River Jordan.
Rhea, apart from this depiction of both St. Peter and St. John the Baptist in the Last Judgment fresco, these two figures appear elsewhere in the Sistine Chapel in a different manner.
You have the fresco on the lower part of the Sistine, where you have Peter receiving the keys from Christ. You also have the first fresco just to the right of the altar, where you see St. John the Baptist baptizing Christ. And again, in that fresco below, he's shown in his more classical garb, holding the long cross, standing with one foot on a rock and one foot in the water, and he's baptizing Christ. And he's wearing the robes that we normally associate him with. So again, it's a repetition here. He's repeated in the Sistine Chapel. So this also underlines the importance of his role. He sometimes holds a lamb, which has a cruciform nimbus, no? The lamb is one of his iconographical attributes, because he was the one who said, "Behold the Lamb of God." He's here to one side of Christ, and he's the person who brought the message to the people and brought the direct link to the Messiah who came. And on the other side, you have St. Peter, who received that message and brought it down into the Sistine Chapel for us. And this is where... this is why this link with the Pope is so terribly important, because you're coming through the prophets, through the revelation, which is an action. Obviously, here you have the judgment, but it's the judgment as the result of the revelation. And then on the right-hand side, you have Peter, who created, let's say, the earthly church. And then below that, you have the altar of the Pope.
So Michelangelo was a very knowledgeable person about the church.
Well, yeah, not only knowledgeable, but he was also very religious. This is something people tend to forget, because I think Michelangelo had this extraordinary capacity to immerse himself in what he was trying to paint. And trying to give the totality of his spiritual self to creating something that would give and inspire a message in the people who are observing for years to come.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently teaching at the American University of Rome, and who, as you may have gathered, happens to be an artist herself. Finally, on a more reflective note, time to join well-known theologian and author, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, currently based in Australia, as he brings us a reflection by the title of Loving You Always. Thank you.
Years ago, a great songwriter, Irving Berlin, composed his piece, I'll Be Loving You Always. At the time, a friend said to him, people don't love each other always. Why don't you call your new song, I'll Be Loving You Thursday? Well, thank God, Irving Berlin refused to change the title and the text and gave us his beautiful song as I'll Be Loving You Always. In a sense, of course, his friend was right. Unfortunately, many people don't love each other always. They want to. They would like to be loving and faithful for a whole lifetime, come what may. Yet we are weak. Our love can grow cold. We can become unfaithful and unloving to each other. But with God, things are different. God is always loving and always faithful to us, come what may. God's love never grows cold. Our loving God is totally faithful and utterly loving to each one of us. This is the heart of the message Jesus brought, the message Jesus himself was. Jesus being with us was and is God's way of saying to us all, I'll be loving you always. There are no limits to this love. It goes on and on and on, not just for many years and not just for our whole lifetime. God's love for each of us lasts forever. You must have seen that advertisement in jewelry stores, diamonds are forever. When a young man gets engaged and buys a ring, he wants the love he feels for his fiancée to last forever. He cherishes her deeply and yearns to love her always. Alas, the love we yearn and hope for, we don't always find in ourselves, but we do find it in God. With God, diamonds are forever. When Jesus came among us, God was saying to us, I'll be loving you always, not for just a day, not for just a year. I'll be loving you always. So thank you, Irving Berlin, for your song. I'm glad you didn't change your text, but kept those words, I'll be loving you always.
You were listening there to well-known theologian and author, Jesuit Father Gerald O. Collins, currently based in Australia. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. And then make sure you click on English World. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.